From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, young girls, self-esteem, and the confidence gap. We talk with journalist Peggy Orenstein about her study investigating why many junior high school girls have self-esteem problems. Orenstein compares the pressures faced by suburban and inner-city girls. Also today, a sort of love story. Alan Zweibel has written a new memoir about his friendship with Gilda Radner. They first met while working together on the original Saturday Night Live. Their collaboration resulted in some of Gilda's memorable characters and in a friendship that lasted until her death in 1989. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Natural Ingredients by the four-woman band Luscious Jackson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. American advocates for Haitian refugees say they're afraid the Clinton administration will force refugees to return to Haiti before their safety can be guaranteed. The advocates say most of the refugees have based their asylum requests on their fear of persecution by the military junta, and they say they're concerned that the U.S. will consider that threat over too soon. President Clinton and his military advisors briefed congressional leaders on the Haiti situation today, emphasizing that the diplomatic agreement made with the junta has reduced the danger for American troops by averting an invasion.
Our troops have already entered Haiti peacefully. Under the command of Lieutenant General Hugh Shelton, our troops are working with full cooperation with the Haitian military. We must be prepared for the risks that remain to the troops, but we should recognize that we are in a much stronger and safer position to achieve our goals in Haiti today.
There was some violence today, but American troops were not involved. Anti-junta demonstrators clashed with police. Hundreds of civilians turned out to watch American Marines land in amphibious vehicles in the northern Haitian city of Cap-Hétienne. They were just curious, and police kept them out of the Marines' way. The exiled president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, has not endorsed the deal the Clinton administration made with the military rulers. Here's more from UPI's Carol Van Dam.
Aides to Aristide say the plan is illegitimate because it was signed by the military's installed president, Emile Jonassant. Former President Jimmy Carter insists Jonassant is not a puppet president and disputes administration claims that the military regime committed atrocities. The State Department's Mike McCurry says Carter is wrong.
If need be, we can put former President Carter in direct contact with some very brave individuals at our embassy in Port-au-Prince who've gone out and done the reporting on those human rights abuses.
Meanwhile, Republicans on Capitol Hill are demanding to know how long U.S. troops will be in Haiti and at what cost. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
The Internal Revenue Service is trying some new things to cut down on computer-based fraud. The IRS says it will require professional tax preparers who file people's returns electronically to submit to fingerprinting and a credit check. The agency hopes to screen out preparers who might be inclined to take advantage of the quick refunds electronic filing offers. Stock and bond prices were down today. Just before the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 64 points, triggering the New York Exchange's cap on program traders. The slide follows a report that the trade deficit worsened in July by 21%. Economists say the overall picture is not as bad as that sounds because there was a big drop in overseas sales of American commercial jetliners that could easily rebound. This is NPR News. The powerful Zulu community in South Africa is facing a political split between two of its top leaders. The Zulu king, Goodwill Zwelithini, says he has fired his uncle, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, as his chief advisor. Buthelezi has dominated Zulu politics for four decades and is the leader of the Inkatha Freedom Party, the main rival to the ruling African National Congress. The king has been only a minor player in the anti-apartheid movement, but his decision could weaken Buthelezi and could spark more bloody fighting between Inkatha and ANC supporters. A dispute over recognition of Taiwan is casting a shadow over the start of the Asian Games in Japan next month. Tokyo refused today to abide by China's demand that Taiwanese officials be barred from attending the Games. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
With less than 2 weeks to go before the opening of Asia's largest sporting event, the question of who's on the guest list has threatened a Chinese boycott, prompted an about-face by the Asian Olympic Committee and embarrassed the Japanese government. It began with an invitation to the president of Taiwan, Li Tenghui. China, which considers Taiwan a breakaway province, balked at the Asian Olympic Committee's hospitality toward Taipei. Facing the threat of a Beijing boycott, the committee effectively retracted Li's invitation, but said the vice premier, who heads Taiwan's bid for the Games in the year 2002, could come. It's a compromise Tokyo can live with. Taiwan is one of its most important trading partners, and today Japan told China it's got to live with it too. In Tokyo, I'm Julie McCarthy.
O.J. Simpson's grown children say their father does not need to deny to them that he killed his ex-wife Nicole because it's understood that he could not commit such a heinous act. Jason and Arnell Simpson, who were born during O.J. Simpson's first marriage, have been interviewed on NBC today as their father faces the start of his trial on Monday. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of the gains made by the women's movement, many adolescent girls get stuck in a self-esteem crisis. A 1990 study by the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, found that girls' self-esteem plummets when they reach adolescence. After my guest Peggy Orenstein read that study, she decided to do some research of her own. She spent the 1992-93 school year following eighth-grade girls in two California schools, Weston, a suburban middle school with a reputation for excellence, and Audubon Middle School, which Orenstein describes as serving a beleaguered urban community that is nearly 90% ethnic minority, mostly poor or working poor. In association with the AAUW, she's published her findings in her new book, Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. Orenstein is former managing editor of Mother Jones magazine. She told me about the AAUW study of adolescent girls that inspired her to investigate further.
The AUW did a survey called Shortchanging Girls, Shortchanging America that showed that girls' self-esteem plummets further than boys at adolescence and never really catches back up. And when I read about that report in my morning paper, it just kind of catapulted me back to that time, I guess. I really remembered what it felt like to be a young girl and to receive those mixed messages that I think a lot of us received about second-class status in the classroom, about the importance of intelligence versus the importance of appearance, about struggles with body image, about struggles with developing a healthy sexuality. And I got to thinking about it, and I just really wanted to go back and see what it was like for girls today.
Let's start with Weston first, the suburban school.
Sure.
And you found here that most girls were overtly encouraged to fulfill their potential, and yet they learned different lessons anyways.
When you're talking about the classroom, what happens is that boys learn to get ahead and girls learn to get along. So that when I would go into, say, a math classroom at Weston, there would always be some boys in the class who would be shooting their hand up when they had an answer and yelling, me, 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 and sometimes even snapping their fingers, whereas what would happen with the girls is that they would raise their hands politely and play by the rules, and the boys got rewarded for that behavior, and they knew it, so that after class one day I was standing and talking to a boy named Nate, who was saying to me, you know, the girls, they raise their hand when they have a question, and they will leave their hand up until the bell rings and the teacher won't call on them. Well, forget about that. When I have something to say, I yell it out, because even if I get in trouble, and even if the teacher yells at me, I still always get my answer.
One of the teachers even said to you, I definitely play to the boys, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and, you know, the boys are louder.
Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, I actually had the same problem. I have to admit, when I was doing the research for Schoolgirls, I'd sit in the classrooms, and boys would pull my attention away from what I was doing all the time. And I think because, you know, I'm a nice girl, too, I had a hard time saying to them, you know, knock it off, bub, I'm trying to watch the girls over here. I would kind of say, yeah, well, what is it that you want? And then turn back to the girls. And then, you know, I kept getting my attention pulled away. So it's not so easy.
You say the worst things that you could call a girl at Weston is either a schoolgirl or a slut. Mm-hmm. What's the meaning of those two expressions?
A schoolgirl is like a perfect girl. It's the girl who does her homework, is very prim, is prissy, proper, probably doesn't talk a lot in class. It's a good girl. It's the, you know, the age-old good girl. Girl doesn't want to be a good girl, and yet the not the only alternative, but the other end of the spectrum, which is worse, is that a girl doesn't want to be a slut. What I found was that the girls were encouraged to be desirable, to be attractive to boys, and that was something that was very important to them, and yet they were discouraged from feeling any desire themselves. So it made this weird split in them that was where they viewed their own desire as something bad and dangerous, and they feared being called a slut.
How did they explain to you that they feared having any desires themselves?
Well, there's actually a chapter in the book called Sluts, where we talk about that. And I really go through the story of one girl in that chapter, Evie. And Evie considered having sex with a boy. And her story is just sort of a typical story of Western girls' attitude towards sex, towards their desire of seeing intercourse as the fulcrum of sex, of thinking about intercourse, you know, way too young. These girls are thinking about it at 12 and 13 in a really serious way, which is something I think parents, you know, need to get a handle on. And this boy asked her to have sex, and she had a dream. She started having dreams, nightmares, of a girl that she knew who had sex with a boy, and then he dumped her, and then he'd say he loved her, and she'd go back and have sex with him again, and then he would dump her, and she's now in a school for troubled girls or some kind of continuation school, whereas the boy is still at Weston and still popular, and she was afraid that if she ended up having sex with this boy that would happen to her. And so with Evie, for her, considering sex made her feel bad about herself, made her feel like she was a slut, made her feel like she had to suppress her desire. You know, what she said, some of these girls were so almost literary sometimes in the way that they talked. She said that she wished that her soul were a piece of glass so she could get some Windex and wipe it clean. And that was how she was feeling about herself.
Even though she hadn't had sex.
Even though she hadn't had it. And the girls, you know, as we go through that chapter, you see that kind of coming up again and again, this split between being desired and desiring.
The self-esteem of girls is very tied in to how they look, more so than boys. At least that's one of the findings of the American Association of University Women's
Study. And lots
study,
of other people.
And lots of other people, too.
Yeah.
How much trouble did the girls you studied, how much trouble did they have with eating disorders?
That's a big issue. I mean, it's not just even eating disorders. You know, some girls, of course, develop eating disorders, but it's just negative body image in general and believing that, you know, that they're too fat when they're normal, that they're too fat when they're thin, that unless they have an eating disorder, that they're too fat. So, you know, I was on the schoolyard one day with the girls, and one of the girls pointed at a potato chip wrapper at another girl's foot and said, "Becca, you know, you littered." And Becca said, "I didn't litter. I don't eat." And the other girl said, "You don't eat? I don't eat either." And they gave each other the thumbs up sign. You know, and I was standing there and I was just appalled. You know, I think that parents don't know. The girls talk about body and about, you know, and there's part of them, they'll say, "I know that it's not the most important thing to be thin. I know that I don't have to look like a model." And yet, they also don't know that. And in a really deep internalized way, they don't think they have the right to eat. And this was really endemic with the girls in the middle class school. I was really surprised, I guess, not so much that they had body image issues, but how young. I mean, these girls are 13, and it was really already entrenched. So you wonder, you know, must have gotten there early. I know that there's some studies that say that girls as young as 7 have internalized this idea of thinness as success, thinness as beauty.
Let's shift our attention to the inner city school that you looked at and compare what was happening with the girls there. One of the things that you noticed was that in this school, girls were more likely than boys to attend school on a regular basis. Were they more ready, though, to speak up in class and, you know, to be active participants in class, too?
Yeah, especially a lot of the African-American girls really were quite vocal in class, but that was not necessarily encouraged or used in a positive way. You know, generally what happens with African-American girls in class is that very vocal girls are used kind of as rule enforcers, as kind of junior teachers, as junior disciplinarians, so that a lot of times you'll see a teacher say, "Okay, everybody be quiet now," and this girl will put her hands on her hips and say, "Okay, everybody be quiet now," and she's not necessarily getting reinforced for academic participation, but for some sort of stereotypical behavior.
What behavior?
For being a kind of assertive, disciplinarian black woman.
You said that the word respect came up almost obsessively
mm-hmm.
among the girls that you spoke with. What were the things that they thought conferred respect on them and the things that didn't really matter in terms of getting respect?
Well, I think in general at Audubon, what mattered was survival. And survival was more important than school. So that the things that conferred respect were the things that helped one survive, whether that was being good with your fists or something like that. And doing well in school was not something that conferred respect necessarily because it did not help you survive in an area that was, you know, a really tough environment. And what I saw with the girls, that a lot of what conferred power and competence and self-worth, you know, like I said, girls tend to take on their mother's problems. And what would happen in the urban environment was that the girls would actually take on their mother's roles, so that a girl like LaRonda in the book or April in the book or other girls whose mothers are unable to take care of their children because they're working mothers, single working mothers with no child care, or because they're single mothers with many children and just don't have the time and energy to take care of all of them, or because in one of the girls' cases her mom was incapacitated by chemical dependency on crack, the girl stands up and she becomes the mom, and she's got to take care of the younger kids, and she does that at the expense of her own education and her own future. And it's a really important thing to know, because there was one study that I read that said that that is the reason why 25% of girls drop out because of that, not because they're having their own children, but because they have to mother their siblings. And so a girl like LaRonda, who was very bright and felt this strong sense of competence that was not being recognized at the school, you know, I'd meet her third period. She was just getting to school. She was dabbing on her lipstick. She was messing with her braids. And, you know, she'd gotten her she said, I don't care if I miss school. My brothers and sisters need me. I have to get them up. I have to get them dressed. I have to make the breakfast. I got to get them to school. But the competence that she's showing is not recognized in school. It just becomes a battle. So that when I was talking to one of her counselors, you know, he was saying, you know, I don't care why she's late. She's late. He didn't know why she was late.
Journalist Peggy Orenstein is my guest. Her new book is called Schoolgirls, Young Women's Self-Esteem and the Confidence Gap. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about adolescent girls and their crisis in confidence. My guest is journalist Peggy Orenstein. Now, for the girls at the suburban school, self-image was so important, mm-hmm. physical self-image. And there were a lot of eating disorders and mm-hmm. a lot of insecurities. Am I too fat? Mm-hmm. You know, am I pretty enough? Was there anything comparable among the African-American girls at the inner city school?
Well, I think that the body image problems were not the same. You know, I think in African-American culture, bigness is allowed for women. You know, it's okay to be big. I mean, sometimes bigness is fetishized in rap music and all of that kind of thing. But there's also a way that black women are allowed power, they're allowed size. And one of the girls, one of the real bright rays of hope in the book is Dashelle, who is a really big girl. And she made the honor roll every quarter. And at one point I said to her, you know, are you ever concerned about being big? Do you think boys won't like you or something? And she said, it don't matter to me that I'm healthy. Why would that bother me? It's my brain, not my body, that's going to get somewhere. She was the only girl I heard say that.
What about the other girls? How much was a body image a really important self-defining issue?
It just wasn't. You know, I think that having powerful bodies, particularly in an urban area, was kind of helpful. You know, it helped. It was strength and power, and you needed that physical power to survive.
One of the girls told you that she thought if she wanted to achieve what she did, and if she wanted to succeed, that the most important thing she needed to do was to basically stay away from boys, to not mm-hmm. have a boyfriend.
Yeah, that was Dashelle, and I heard that from a number of girls, that they felt that the only thing that was going to keep them safe was to lock out their social life, and it was such an improbable thing, you know, that they were going to make it through high school deprived of friends and deprived of companionship from boys. You know, that's part of adolescence. But the teachers agreed with that. I talked to one of the teachers about it who said, you know, she's talked to high school teachers and she sees that the kids who want to get ahead have to be like they're wearing blinders. It was interesting, though. You know, I asked LaRonda about her role models while I was reporting schoolgirls, and she said that there was one boy in her neighborhood who sold crack, but he went to high school, too, and got good grades. And she said, you know, the other boys called him schoolboy. There could also be schoolboys, although it wasn't as bad as being a schoolgirl. The other boys called him schoolboy, and they made fun of him, and they said, you know, you can't do both, you can't do both. And he said he was going to do both, and she said, you know, he's a role model. He's a role model for us all.
You said that you thought the Latina girls had more of a self-esteem problem than the African-American girls,
yeah.
And that was also a conclusion that the American Association of University Women reached in its study.
Yeah.
What were the signs of this lower self-esteem?
The girls are, a lot of the Latina girls are very quiet. A lot of them sort of slip through until they slip out. It's hard, you know, there's not a lot of attention paid to their culture. There's a lot of stereotyping of Latina girls as being from a certain kind of culture that treats its girls and women a certain way, and so there's nothing you can do about that. Latina girls, you know, particularly in the West and Southwest, I don't know so much about the rest of the country, are very vulnerable to gangs right now. And Marta, who's the Latina girl who I focus on most particularly in the book, is going through the process of, you know, when she was a younger girl, she was thinking about being a lawyer. She was really excited about school. And she had been slipping. You know, I talked to teachers about her, and sometimes they weren't even sure who she was. And by the end of the year I spent with her, at the beginning of the year, she said, you know, she'd point out girls and gangs to me and say, you know, those girls, they think it's all about being in a gang. And you know how they get into the gang is that sometimes it's the same way boys do, that they just beat the girls up. But sometimes they have to sleep with every boy in the gang or a select number of boys or men, adult men, in the gang in order to gain entree. And by the end of the year, she seemed pretty much ready to do that. She was choosing between gangs like she was choosing between sororities.
What was your reaction to her? Were you able to maintain your distance as just observer when you found that out?
No, actually, that was the other time when I broke through. There was a woman who was coming into Audubon. This was a really great thing. She was from the YWCA, and she was a young Latina woman from these girls' neighborhood. She was about 21 years old, and she was leading a support group for the eighth grade girls, which, you know, started out being fairly small, but over the course of the week got bigger and bigger and bigger until she almost couldn't do anything with the girls. There were so many of them. And I did tell her that Marta was thinking, and it was clear she would go around every session and have a check-in where the kids would talk about whatever was going on with them that week. And it became clear that Marta was on the peripheries of a gang, and I told her that I knew that she was seriously considering jumping in. And unfortunately, it was the very end of the school year, and I don't know that she could do anything about it at that point, but at least she was alerted.
What issues in your life did this work bring back up again?
Man, this catapulted me right back to adolescence, and I have to say, you know, this was a hard book. Schoolgirls was a hard book to report because it kept me right there the whole time. It kept me just nose to nose with everything that happened to me in adolescence. And, you know, I dragged my friends right back there with me, so it kept them nose to nose, too. And it actually seems to have that effect on readers. And in the end, it was a really healthy thing for me. It was very painful. It brought me up against not only some of the ways that I remember pulling back in school, but other ways I remembered pulling back. I talk just a little bit in the book about having an eating disorder when I was in high school. And, you know, back then, I had never heard the word anorexia. I didn't know what eating disorders were. And I was very lucky because a good friend of our family was a doctor who was doing early research in eating disorders. He was an endocrinologist. And he pulled me aside and talked to me about it and really helped me through that period. Otherwise, I think, like some girls, I probably would have ended up in the hospital.
You say in the book that you lost 40 pounds and then you basically stopped eating.
Well, I stopped eating in order to lose them.
Oh, okay. Well, I think what you say is you couldn't eat after that.
Yeah, you become, I mean, it's something that I remember as just like being down a dark tunnel. You know, nothing else mattered. I remember my school notebooks, you know, how you doodle on your school notebook. Mine was just covered with numbers, you know, when I was trying to figure out calories so that I could keep I think 500 was the number I decided was like the magic minimum that I could eat and survive and not pass out during the day. But my mind was on nothing else most of the time. You know, it was not on my schoolwork, although I still continued to do well. But, you know, it was just on this constant obsession of what I looked like. And I just had no idea. And I think that's something that, you know, I know so many women who have gone through that and who've had negative body images. And I don't really think it goes away.
One thing that's really mystified me, I figured, you know, since I came of age at the beginning of the resurgence of the women's movement, and I figured, well, boy, by the time, you know, the next generation comes of age, they're going to, feminism is going to be so ingrained in them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of equality is going to be so ingrained in them. They'll be living completely different lives than I have and be free from those insecurities that defined part of my life. And I mean, what happened? It seems to be almost the other way around, that girls today, in spite of mm-hmm. feminism, are growing up with even more eating disorders and insecurities mm-hmm. and problems in school and, you know, obsessions with boys and, uh-huh. and so on. Do you have anything you've been thinking about that helps explain that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's important to recognize the progress that has been made,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that is, I think, great. You know, I think that girls do have a lot more role models, that people don't say, you know, girls can't anymore, that girls are not hearing like I did, that it's the, you know, the woman author of the math book was responsible for the mistakes in the math book. And yet it is true that girls are still struggling with this stuff. And I think, you know, so are adult women, you know, and I think that girls see what adult women are going through, and I think that they absorb it. I also think, you know, I've got to think that the last 12 years of setbacks are partially responsible for what's going on with girls. I think that that has hurt, and, you know, in the political realm and during the Reagan-Bush years. I think those were very repressive years for women, and I think that those were repressive years for girls, and we're seeing some of the trickle-down. The trickle-down effect is that, you know, it goes from adult women who are in the workplace and who are having all these kinds of conflicts to their daughters.
I guess one of the things that really interested me in your book is that you didn't really find that on the whole teachers or parents were overtly sexist.
No, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I just, you know, I just don't want to demonize teachers. I think that teachers have such a hard job and they're trying really hard, and they're, you know, most of them, there were a few clinkers in there, but most of them are really caring, good people who want to do right by their students.
And yet there's all this sexist stuff happening in the schools and at home, but it's not because of a total lack of consciousness. It's not because of overt sexism.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of the thing is, I think that I've really come to feel strongly that this message has to go to boys as well as girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really big part of the problem, is that we need to change the way we raise our sons and the way they treat the girls. Because there was actually a recent New York Times poll that showed, they surveyed, it was a New York Times CBS poll, and they surveyed the ways boys and girls see one another. And boys see themselves as superior to girls, and girls see themselves as equal to boys. This is a very bad recipe.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it was really fun. Thanks, Terry.
Peggy Orenstein is the author of the new book, Schoolgirls. The great songwriter Julie Stein died today at the age of 88. It would be hard to grow up in America without knowing some of his songs, like I Don't Want to Walk Without You, It's Been a Long, Long Time, It's Magic, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, Just in Time, The Party's Over, People, and Everything's Coming Up Roses. We'll close this half hour with Frank Sinatra, who recorded many Julie Stein songs, singing Time After Time. The lyric is by Stein's longtime collaborator Sammy Kahn. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loving you. So lucky to be the one you run to see in the evening when the day is through.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Comedy writer Ellen Zweibel and Gilda Radner shared the same sense of humor, the same anxieties, and a friendship that lasted 14 years. They met on the original Saturday Night Live and teamed up to create Radner's Roseanne Roseanna Dana and Emily Latella. Coming up, we talk with Zweibel about their friendship. It's the subject of his new memoir. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Natural Ingredients, the first full-length collection by the four-woman band Luscious Jackson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Anti-military demonstrators began challenging Haitian police today in Port-au-Prince. Apparently emboldened by the presence of American troops, about 5,000 demonstrators gathered in a neighborhood considered a stronghold of the exiled president. Protesters threw rocks at police, who dispersed the crowd by swinging clubs and firing guns into the air. President Clinton and his top military advisors briefed congressional leaders on the Haitian situation at the White House today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton told the congressional leaders that American troops have entered Haiti peacefully and that they are working with the full cooperation of the Haitian military.
This is a very different and a much better day than it would have been had we not been able to successfully combine the credible threat of force with diplomacy.
The president said that in a matter of months, U.S. troops will hand over the responsibility for maintaining basic security in Haiti to the U.N. U.S. officials say about half the U.S. troops will leave at that time. But there are many problems ahead. One is the growing rift between the White House and soon-to-be-reinstated Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Aristide issued a terse statement today that said nothing at all about the agreement or the occupation. President Clinton has not spoken with Aristide since Friday, but National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, who briefed Aristide throughout the weekend, said this is a difficult moment for him. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A former French prime minister and two former cabinet members are expected to be charged later this month in connection with the distribution of HIV-infected blood. Several top medical officials have already been convicted in connection with the case. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Former socialist prime minister Laurent Fabius, who led the French government in the mid-1980s, will appear before a special inquiry commission next week for questioning in connection with the blood scandal. His former health minister and minister of social affairs will also be questioned by the commission. Judicial sources said all three will be charged with complicity in poisoning hemophiliacs. Several hundred have died from AIDS-related diseases. French hemophiliacs accused Fabius of allowing the distribution of contaminated blood in order to give a French company time to develop an AIDS test for blood donors. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The UN has suspended its humanitarian airlift into Sarajevo again after a French plane was hit by a bullet. No one was hurt. The UN thinks the bullet may have been a stray round, not fired deliberately at the plane. The airport had been open for only a few hours after being closed for the day yesterday by the fighting in and around Sarajevo. The Bosnian Serbs have cut the land links into Sarajevo, so the airlift has assumed added importance. On Wall Street, stocks plunged today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped by 67 points. This is NPR. Burma's military rulers have met with opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, whom they've kept under house arrest for 5 years. Burmese state television showed pictures of Suu Kyi meeting with junta members. Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991 for the democracy movement she led. In the past, Suu Kyi has said she would meet with the military rulers, but would not accept their condition for her release, which is that she leave Burma. Tamil rebels killed 25 Sri Lankan sailors today. Officials say the rebels used two boats packed with explosives to ram Sri Lanka's largest Navy warship. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The Sri Lankan Navy ship was on a surveillance mission off the island's northwest coast when it was rammed by three small boats loaded with explosives. More than 40 sailors were believed to be on board the Navy ship. Only 16 survived. Five of the Tamil rebels also died. Today's attack comes after apparent progress in ending the island's 10-year civil war. Sri Lanka's newly elected Prime Minister, Chandrika Kumaratunga, had recently eased the four-year-old economic embargo against the Tamil rebels and invited them to peace talks. But today's attack, the worst of its kind, demonstrates that any peace settlement in Sri Lanka won't come easily. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
A health survey says too many American children are not getting the right diet and they're watching too much television. Prevention magazine says two-thirds of American youngsters fail its Children's Health Index. The survey finds a slight increase in overweight children over the past 10 years and a big increase in parents who don't try to limit fat and sugar in the family menus. A magazine spokesman says parents may be overwhelmed by competing nutrition advice and have given up. The survey finds fewer than half of American youngsters get enough strenuous exercise and that 41% of families that own guns do not lock them up. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Zweibel got his start writing jokes for Borscht Belt comics. He went on to write for Saturday Night Live and It's Gary Shandling Show. And he wrote the screenplay for the recent film North, which he adapted from his book of the same name. During his years at Saturday Night Live, he collaborated with Gilda Radner, co-creating some of the characters she became famous for, like Emily Letella and Roseanne Adana. With the exception of a couple of falling outs, they remained close friends until her death from cancer in 1989. Zweibel's just written a memoir about their relationship called Bunny Bunny. Here's how they met at Saturday Night Live.
It was the first day. I was 24 years old, and I'm in Lorne Michaels' office, and he has all the writers and the actors for this new show. And I felt so out of place in the midst of all these people that I hid behind a plant, which was in the corner of Lorne Michaels' office. I squatted down behind it, trying to remain as inconspicuous as possible for fear that I would either be called upon or exposed as a fraud of some sort. And I'm down there, and I heard this voice come through the leaves say, can you help me be a parakeet? And I looked up, and it was Gilda. I said, what? She said, yeah, I think it would be really funny if I stood on this perch, a big perch, and sort of squished up my face and squawked. But I need a writer to help me figure out what the parakeet should squawk. Can you help me squawk? And I had no idea what she was talking about, but I was thankful that somebody, in fact, was talking to me. And I said, you bet. And we got to talking, and I realized about halfway through the conversation that she was as scared as I was.
There's a story you tell in your book that has to do with Gilda that I thought was really a scream. There was a party for her at Studio 54, and so she invited your parents to come. And so, you know, there's like, I guess, Mick and Bianca.
well, it was amazing. You
and
know,
your
look,
parents.
She had come to my house one time, and I lived in Long Island, and we took the Long Island Railroad out to my parents' house. And my mom, what she did was, anybody who she thought was famous or was going to be famous, she had them sign the underside of our kitchen chairs. Now, my parents now live in Delray Beach in Florida, okay? And if you should go to their house, and you're more than welcome to, that if you turn over their kitchen chairs, you'll see Billy Crystal's name, you'll see Bell's name, you'll see Gilda's name. So we have these famous chairs, you know, in my mom's house. So, you know, Gilda came over for dinner and she signed a chair. And my mom was basically showing her off. You know, we went to a shopping mall to get a cake. And we realized that something was wrong. My mother probably had a different agenda because this mall had no bakery in it. There was clearly no bakery. So we couldn't imagine where we were going to get this cake. So she was just basically taking her in from one shop to another. Hey, look who my son knows. She then called another couple who she never got along with because they were always bragging about their son's success. She invited them over, and they brought a cake, okay? And they invited them over just basically to show off, okay? I felt real guilty about this, and I kept on saying, gee, I owe you. I'm sorry I've subjected you to this, da-da-da. And she was real sweet. And I knew that she would get back at me somehow. About a week or so later, at Studio 54, there was this huge party, which they threw for Gilda and the other cast members. And I'm walking around, and, you know, look, this is 1976. and there's strobe lights, and you know, there's real blaring music, and you know, and it was just, you know, it was Studio 54, whatever that was, and I'm looking in a corner of the room, and I'm going, no, that can't be. And I figured it was the strobes that was distorting the image, and I walk closer and I walk closer, and in fact, I do see my mother dancing with Halston and my father trying to look down Bianca Jagger's dress. You know, she's like seated and my father was like walking around with a drink in his hand. And I'm going, how the hell did this happen? Who invited them? And I sought Gilda out and I said, what'd you do here? What is this? You did this, didn't you? And that was her way of getting back at me, you know, for going to the, you know, the mall with for a cake that had no bakery and all of that. She invited them to this party, unbeknownst to me, and was really a shock. What was even more shocking about it was also at the party, she invited that same couple who my mother had come over with the cake, you know. They were at the party. She invited High and Rhoda Rappaport to the party. And next to them on the bar was a cake box. She had this couple bring a cake to Studio 54. And what the hell? How do you, that's amazing to me.
Now, your book is subtitled A Sort of Love Story. And let me explain where I think the sort of comes in. I mean, you loved each other as friends, but it sounds like you really wanted to love each other as lovers. But she kept saying that you shouldn't let the girl thing and the boy thing come, the girl-boy thing come between you. She was really afraid that your relationship could be ruined if you became more intimate. So was that hard for you?
Yeah, it was difficult at first, but it was logical as well, only because it was a time of changes for two people who met on a show like this, who were going through the changes of success, and in her case, fame, and then the ups and downs of whatever anybody's lives are like over a 15-year period of time. The hope was that we would sustain and be there for each other, and it was logically decided that we would try our best to just keep it creative and friendly.
How did Gilda break the news to you that she was sick?
For months, I was told by her that she had Epstein-Barr virus.
That's a virus that leaves you feeling exhausted all the time.
It's like mono in a way, I guess. And, you know, people would you'd run this real low-grade temperature, and there were stretches of time where you're just tired and you'd sleep forever and all of that. And about a month or so later, we were on the phone, and she had mentioned that she heard from the doctors and she didn't have Epstein-Barr virus. And I thought, oh, wow, this is great. We could we can play. We can go out and have fun because she won't be sleeping all the time anymore or having those symptoms. And I said, oh, wow, that's terrific. And she said, I have cancer. And I said, what? And she said, I have ovarian cancer, and I need you to get me through this part of my life. And I said, sure. What should I do? And she said, just make me laugh. And we started that part.
Was that hard to do, to be funny when she was so sick?
Well, yeah, you know, you're with somebody who is has this horrible disease, and it's got a horrible name, and you know how it usually ends, and you want to ask them how they are. You don't know how to act, you know. You don't know what to say, but it seems like you should be talking about it, but. She was a different kind of a spirit. All she really cared about was life and hope and positive stuff. So on one hand, your heart went out, but on the other hand, you knew that the best thing you could do as a friend was to stress the positive and just keep that part going.
My guest is Alan Zweibel. His new book, Bunny Bunny, is about his friendship and collaboration with Gilda Radner. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. back with comedy writer Ellen Zweibel.
Gilda Radner was the first person you wrote for who you were writing for a character, not just telling jokes. I'm interested in some of the jokes that you wrote back when you were writing for the comics who were in the Borscht Belt, in the Catskill Mountains. You said you wrote for Toadie Fields, for Rodney Dangerfield. What kind of material were you doing for them? Well, remember any of the jokes?
Well, I see. First of all, I must tell you that I had to graduate to that level. When I first started...
Oh, it was the unknowns first. Huh?
Oh, you know something? Every Morty, every Lee, every Freddy that ever lived, I wrote for, okay? I was 22 years old. I was just out of college. In college, I started sending jokes to Dick Cavett and Johnny Carson and Mad Magazine, you know, to get started. And so my mom and dad went to Lake Tahoe, and they saw Engelbert Humperdinck. This is the summer of 1972. And on the bill was a comedian named Morty Gunty, who was this Catskill comedian. And my mom saw him in a coffee shop the next day, mentioned me to him. And I started writing for him and some of these other Catskill guys. They were twice as old as I was. So I was basically wanting to write jokes about, you know, having sex or marijuana or whatever political left thing I was into at the time. And these guys wanted jokes about paving the driveway, you know.
The kids today.
These nutty kids, you know. And I'm going, wow. So I would write jokes for them for $7 a joke. And what was great about it was I would send them the McDonald's routine. I would send them the joke about the Hasidic porno movie where the orgy scene had the men on one side and the women on the other. I would do those jokes about my grandfather having an electronic pacemaker in his heart, which worked great, except every time he sneezed, the garage door went up. I sent them all of that stuff. And then the fun part would happen because I'd get in my parents' car and I'd go up to the Raleigh Hotel or the Concord. And some of the guys would just give me $7 if they accepted the jokes. Many of them would only give me the $7 if the joke got a laugh. Well, that's when the fun really began, because I'm sitting in the audience. I clearly heard a laugh. And they're on stage, and afterwards they go, "Nah, it bombed." I'm going, "What are you talking about? What constitutes a laugh with you?" And then what happened was many of the jokes they wouldn't buy because it wasn't for their audience.
You know, a lot of the comics today have personas. They do their act in persona, mm-hmm. like Gilbert Gottfried. And, you know, they have a certain kind of voice they use on stage and a certain character that they do.
Sure.
There were a lot of comics who didn't have personas when you started writing, but they had shticks. You know, like Bob Newhart saying was that he was always talking on the phone to somebody.
Right.
Larry Best did a thing where he was
eating
pretending
an apple.
He was eating an apple.
Sure.
Yeah. So did you have to write for people who had a shtick?
Oh, yeah, prior to Saturday Night?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there was a guy named Jerry Shane who did a thing with a rope.
A thing with a rope?
Yeah, I don't remember. That was his. I didn't write that for him, but I remember when I did speak with him a few times, if you can get more stuff for the rope trick stuff. So I was going to write rope tricks. There was weird people like that. There was stuff that didn't pan out. You know, stuff like the apple that Larry Best did. My God, he did that his whole life. That was the one thing that he did, you know. And people were always looking for that kind of hook. People like Rodney Dangerfield would have, you know, "I don't get no respect." So comedians would say, "Can you create a hook for me? Can you create some sort of a moniker that people would know me by?"
Did you make up any?
Well, yeah, I tried to. There was one comic where he wanted me. He talked about he lost his wallet. And he called me on the phone. He says, "You know, I lost my wallet." I went, "Yeah." He says, "And you know what kind of big pain in the neck it is to replace your driver's license and this credit card and that credit card?" I went, "Yeah." He says, "Do you think that could be my hook?" I said, "Let me see if I understand this correctly. You want to be the comic who lost his wallet?" And yeah, he wanted to be the wallet losing comic, you know. And just like Shanling has on his current show, he's got the Jeffrey Tambor character going, "Hey now," you know, just the way McMahon. The guys would say, "Just send me a list of phrases," and maybe one of them would be, you know, "brown shoes." It would be about anything. You just write any three or four words that you wanted. "Hey, I'm over my cold." And they would expect like an applause from that. You know what I mean? You know.
It sounds depressing in a way that there'd be people who were desperate to be comics, and yet they couldn't even come up with what their own personality on stage would be.
I had an experience which was fairly interesting. I had written for a comic in 1973, And I wrote some routines for him and some what were then topical jokes. About 10 years later, either 83, 84, thereabouts, we went up to Catskill Mountain. I guess it was like a winter weekend. We took the kids skiing or something, and there was a show. There was a show there, and the comedian on the bill was one of these guys that I had written for. So we went to the show, and I saw and heard a lot of the jokes that I had written 10 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, we met the comedian at the bar, and he said, you see, your jokes, they're still getting laughs. I said, yeah, that's great. He says, any suggestions? You have anything, any ideas about anything? I said, well, now that you ask, what you might want to consider is that joke that I wrote for you 10 years ago about the Secretary of State. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
Yeah. I said, it might work in your behalf if you take out Kissinger's name and maybe replace it with George Shultz or Cyrus, whoever it was at the time. He's looking at me. I said, you know, that would make it more topical because Kissinger's not the Secretary of State anymore, unless you maybe want to put it in the past tense. But you got to do one of those things. And he says, yeah. He says, if I'm talking about that guy today, he writes down the Secretary of State's name on a cocktail napkin. He says, I'll tell you how it works out. And it was funny, but it's staggering that somebody who you would think does this, has a craft, that this is logical almost, you know? But there's a lot of that.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, this was great.
Alan Zweibel's new memoir about his friendship with Gilda Radner is called Bunny Bunny. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what kind of Haiti coverage do you have on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about a reaction to the agreement with Haiti from the camp of the constitutionally elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Also, we'll be hearing what U.S. forces are doing and what they intend to do in the way of policing Haiti in the coming weeks. We'll also be talking with Dante Caputo, who was the United Nations Secretary General's envoy on Haiti, and who quit that job this morning, seeing no further point to multilateral diplomacy. He says this has turned into a U.S.-Haitian bilateral arrangement. Also, news of Bosnia and of the death of Jules Stein.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last year, the four-woman band Luscious Jackson released an EP called In Search of Manny that attracted a lot of attention and won the Village Voice Critics Poll. Now the group has its first full-length collection out called Natural Ingredients. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The fetus I become, the minute I succumb to your embrace. 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 Dragging in your deep shadow. What I become, what I become. How many deep shacks stuck in rags?
There's a loose, casual confidence to Luscious Jackson's music that immediately puts you at ease and on alert. Any young band that can mix rock and funk and soul with such apparent ease is working on a number of different levels at the same time. Take this smooth-sounding song, for example, Energy Sucker, whose melodic warmth is contradicted by its tough, bitter lyric.
Mother.
Luscious Jackson was formed in Lower Manhattan a few years ago. The band's drummer, Kate Schellenbach, was the original drummer for the Beastie Boys. The group is signed to the Beastie's record label, Grand Royal, and like those boys, these girls are white musicians intent on working variations on black rhythms without merely ripping them off. But where the Beastie Boys want to create a kind of deconstructed rap music, Luscious Jackson is more interested in exploring the variations of a smooth groove. There's a sense in which the members of Luscious Jackson are dilettantes, flitting from one hip style to another. But they're dilettantes in the best sense, people intent on learning as many things as possible to form their own unique sensibility. With this album, they've achieved it.
Ken Tucker reviewed Luscious Jackson's new album, Natural Ingredients. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Please die for me, yeah, yeah.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ann Perry writes popular Victorian murder mysteries. A journalist recently revealed that when Perry was 15, she helped her best friend murder the friend's mother. It's a complicated story that Perry's kept secret for about 40 years. She'll tell us that story on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.